Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last year's American League champs, the Detroit Tigers, need a win to stay alive in the playoffs tonight. You're probably aware of that by now. I've got a battle between the head and the heart going on here. My head keeps reminding me of the recent no-shows by our offense. And to a lesser extent, Justin Verlander's more frequent struggles this season. But, you know, we can beat anybody. It primarily depends on if the bats show up. I worry less about Justin Verlander. In fact, I'm thinking this is just the kind of game Justin Verlander was born to pitch, you know. Jake Neer of NPRN's our first guest this morning. What do you make of tonight?
Well, he's pitched this game before, and it was a good turnout. So, I mean, and given the fact that he's, you know, he seems to have hit his stride, it seems like he's coming out and he's looking like the Justin Verlander of last season, knock on wood. You know, you have to have a little confidence in the guy, I think, and not to mention, I think our bats, you know, may have gotten a spark
perked
the last
up.
Game.
We may have turned the corner with this last game.
I hope so.
Hopefully. Well, anyway, we shall see 8:07 first pitch tonight on TBS, the A's and the Tigers. Yesterday will likely go down as one of Governor Rick Snyder's more memorable days in office. For about 3 hours, attorneys representing influential Michigan labor unions and others had a chance to question the governor under oath about events leading up to his July decision to authorize bankruptcy for the city of Detroit. Now, the media was prohibited from covering the session itself, which took place at the governor's executive office in the Romney Building in downtown Lansing. Still, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Jake Neer spoke with some participants after the deposition. He's been reporting on this here this morning on WKAR, and he joins us now. Give us a little bit more background, please, Jake. What triggered this deposition in the first place?
Well, right now, federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes is looking into whether or not Detroit was actually eligible to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. And one of the big questions, and this is something that unions have claimed, is that the question is whether or not Governor Snyder and the emergency manager that he appointed, Kevin Orr, negotiated in good faith with unions before they filed for bankruptcy. And that's very important. If there was no good faith negotiations, the judge could use that as ground for, you know, it's just basically saying that Detroit's not eligible for this bankruptcy filing.
Now, will the actual questions and answers from yesterday's session be made public at some point? You and the media were barred from the actual session.
Not only that, we were standing outside of the Romney Building in the, yesterday wasn't that cold, but for hours waiting for someone to peek their head out. We ended up only speaking with a union attorney, it seemed to me, and I also spoke with earlier with Governor Snyder's press secretary, who said they want to make this public. Governor Snyder seems like he was willing to participate in this, and that he, what he's saying publicly is he had nothing to hide, and he wants these transcripts to be released. We should probably see those tomorrow, probably at the earliest, is what the governor's office said yesterday.
And you ended up speaking with Sharon Levine. Ms. Levine's an attorney for AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, who put some questions to Governor Snyder. What did she share with you, Jake?
Well, of course, she said that she was very happy that the governor participated in this. It's so rare for a governor. There's questions as to whether or not any sitting governor has ever been deposed in a legal matter before.
Yes.
And so this is very rare. She recognized that. She brought up, of course, the good faith negotiations, and that was a big deal. But the other thing that she was talking about is this question about whether or not retirees, I should say, are going to get their pensions. Here's what she had to say about that.
We were hoping to learn more about what the governor's view was, you know, what was going to happen to the retirees after the Chapter 9, and whether or not he was having conversations with Kevin Orr with regard to what would happen to the retirees after the Chapter 9. And it looks like that's all very much still in flux, and there isn't a solution yet.
So she says she didn't get that answer. She says that she's still not convinced after the deposition, after 3 hours of questioning, that the governor, did act in good faith and negotiate in good faith with unions, along with emergency manager Kevin Orr that she mentioned in that clip. But of course, you know, we're only getting the union side of what happened in that room. So you have to take it with a little grain of salt. It'll be interesting to see what actually comes out when the deposition, and if the deposition is actually released to the public.
But these sessions are over. I mean, there's not going to be another one of these sessions, is there?
As far as I know, there's no plans at this point to have another deposition. And it seems to me like, this is probably, this was their opportunity to put their questions in to Governor Snyder, who was under oath.
And again, was the governor legally obligated to depose himself? I take it the answer to that is no.
Well, it's interesting. I know that the Attorney General Bill Schuette, argued to Judge Stephen Rhodes that he wanted to apply executive privilege and make it so that the governor would not have to do it. But I believe that the court order made it so that it would be tough for the governor not to go in and actually answer these questions. Another issue too that came up is that Sharon Levine and other attorneys with AFSCME said that the governor also claimed attorney-client privilege in a lot of these questions, in response to a lot of these questions, and did not answer them on that ground. Hmm. And one of the things that was sort of an interesting question is whether or not they thought that was an okay response, because I think that when it comes to the governor's selection of Kevin Orr as the emergency manager of Detroit, which was a big question during these, the lead up to this bankruptcy filing, they're saying that the governor was in the room with Kevin Orr and Kevin Orr's attorney, and because of that, he can claim executive, or he can claim attorney-client privilege. So there's a kind of a legal ambiguity here, I think. There's some questions as to whether or not that was kosher, I suppose. But this is just coming from the union attorneys. We'll see, what actually comes out when this is explored a little bit further and the court case moves forward.
Do you get the feeling that the attorneys were expecting to get something of greater value out of Governor Snyder? It sounds as if they were hopeful of more.
The funny thing afterward, as we were standing outside, again, us reporters waiting for someone to come out, was just, if unions did expect Governor Snyder to say something that really, turned on a light switch or, proved one of their points or anything like that, we were just saying, we know what kind of treatment us reporters get from the governor. I have the feeling they're getting the Snyder treatment themselves up there in that room. And he is very, very careful. I mean, he is one of the most, of all the politicians I've covered, he is very careful with his words. He knows what he wants to say. And honestly, he just is not known for making news when he doesn't want to make news.
Well, Rich Studley of the State Chamber of Commerce was quoted in the newspaper yesterday, I do believe, Chad Livengood's story in the Detroit News, pointing out that the governor's not only a CPA, but he's got a law degree as well. So he's pretty savvy with the ins and outs of the legal system as well.
That's
so
absolutely true.
So yeah. What's the future of this here, Jake?
Well, I think going forward, again, the big decision here for Judge Stephen Rhodes in this federal bankruptcy case is whether or not Detroit was eligible to file for Chapter 9. And so the hearings will begin at some point. I'm honestly not 100% sure when those are supposed to start, but soon, I believe. From there, I mean, that's really the big first step as to, getting this moving forward.
One of your recent stories, as it appeared on the WKAR website, enjoyed a few fleeting moments of national fame on Tuesday night when it flashed up on the screen during a segment of the Colbert Report. This was a story you wrote involving medical marijuana. Let's listen to that segment.
It's not enough that pot is no longer bad for us. The dope pushers are now trying to tell us it's the solution for all our fiscal problems, like the Michigan state lawmaker who's proposing to legalize and tax marijuana to boost funding for road repair in a plan supporters call pot for potholes. Yeah, maybe that would work, but once they fix every pothole, what do you think they'll legalize to fix every crack? We'll be right back.
And we should point out that during half of that segment, at least, the visual on the screen was the WKAR website and the story that was really attributed to you on the pot for pothole story, which goes back to September, last month.
Right.
Was that State Rep Mike Calton?
That's correct. Yeah. In fact, there's some questions as to whether or not Representative Calton was the one that actually coined the term pot for potholes. I believe Representative Frank Foster may have been the one that wasn't you. Well, no, I didn't make up the pot for potholes name. No, I can't take credit for that. But I must say, I'm such a big fan of Stephen Colbert. I have been for a long time. It's not often that I get a little, starstruck or whatever. But him reading my parts of my story on Comedy Central really sort of made me a little bit giddy yesterday.
What was more exciting, getting your first story on NPR or your first story on the Colbert Report?
Man. Both of those things. Yeah, and I just had my first story on NPR not too long ago, last month, I believe, and that was also really, really great. And that was actually my voice reading my own story on national radio there, but there's something about being, on the Colbert Report that just made me, I don't know, I think all my social media friends are a little bit sick of hearing about it at this point.
You're on a roll.
Well,
does the pot for potholes idea have legs right now? Have you followed up on that? Do we know?
I have a feeling it's going to be very, I mean, we're talking about legalizing marijuana. That would be a very large, heavy lift, I think, in the legislature, but it has bipartisan support, I will say. I mean, Mike Calton is a Republican, so is Frank Foster. They're the ones that have proposed it. Of course, it's not a bill yet. They haven't actually introduced a bill for pot for potholes yet. But still, I wouldn't expect it to happen anytime soon. But I don't know. I don't know if it would have even been proposed a couple years ago.
How about that? Jake Neer is a reporter along with Rick Pluta. He shares the duties with Rick at covering the state capitol for the Michigan Public Radio Network. WKAR is an affiliate. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks, Mark.
Much of the news coverage of American politics these days centers on the horse race results of polls. Who's ahead? Who's behind? Is this candidate or that issue trending up or down in popularity? But what does that sort of coverage really tell us? Joining us on Current State today is an expert on modern-day political polling. Research psychologist Paul Lavrakis is a consultant for private sector and not-for-profit organizations. He's worked with Google, ABC, the Nielsen Company, the Associated Press, and the Voter News Service. He's written extensively on telephone polling methods, and he's now working on the fifth edition of The Voter's Guide to Election Polls, which will come out in 2015. Paul is an MSU graduate as well. Welcome back to East Lansing, Paul Lavrakis, and welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much.
How important are political polls?
Well, they're very important in many ways. I mean, the public is extremely interested, even if at times they deny that they are. There's a lot of research that shows how greatly interested the public is. Obviously, people that are running for elected office and their staff rely on polls to help them understand where they stand, something that many people don't realize, to help them raise funds. One of the most compelling things to campaign donors is if they think that there are poll results that are showing that their candidate either is leading or has a chance. And so especially at the time of primaries, these pre-primary polls are extremely important to demonstrate candidate viability. The news media obviously have great reliance on polls to help them cover this game that the horse race becomes.
It seems like they can really clutter the landscape, though, at times. They're everywhere, and it feels it's common that you can find a poll that will counter another poll. And this raises confusion and doubts. What are the first questions you ask yourself when you open up the newspaper and you see a new poll in the news?
Well, first of all, I want to make a point that most news organizations have good, stringent expectations and requirements, criteria before they will disseminate the results of a news poll. For example, the Associated Press, and I want to disclose, I am a consultant with them. They have very stringent criteria where, for example, an internet-based poll that doesn't have a reliable sample. The AP is not allowed to publicize anything about that. The New York Times, CBS News, The Wall Street Journal, all the top media in the United States have very good criteria that they use before.
And what is a reliable sample?
Well, first of all, without getting too technical, it needs to be picked in a way that is random and representative of the group that you're trying to cover. We call that a probability sample. And that is a sample that tries to assure that the populace that you're trying to cover gets a fair and representative chance of being sampled for a given survey. Stopping people on the street, going out to a mall, asking people to respond to a pop-up ad on an internet site that they're going to, those are not reliable ways of representing a larger population.
Does that then place the emphasis on telephone polling? Is that more reliable in terms of getting a random representative sample?
If you look over the last two decades in particular, going back to the late 1980s, three decades, let's say, because of the cost differential between in-person interviewing and telephone interviewing, the telephone poll has become the mainstay of pre-election polling. And the challenge over the last decade was what to do about the growing cell phone-only population. And so people like myself, through the major professional organization that I'm a member of and the recent president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, we have led the effort to try to understand how to integrate mobile phones, cell phones, and those numbers into the what now is typically called landline samples. And so telephone polls are still the predominant method. And they use a technique where these numbers are created randomly. They can reach anyone within the population you are. With internet, there's a problem. Most internet surveys are put together in a way that the sample that's drawn, the people that do it have no way of really knowing how representative it is of the group that they're trying to ostensibly represent. Mm-hmm. They have to do all kinds of statistical manipulations to try to make them more representative. There are a couple of internet organizations, polling organizations, that do it differently. And in fact, by coincidence, the Associated Press just announced, I think it was yesterday, that they're now partnering, they're stopping their telephone poll organization. They're not going to be doing polling. They're partnering with an organization that's called GFK that has a scientifically drawn internet sample of people, a panel around the nation, tens of thousands of people who have agreed to participate, but they've been scientifically selected. And in fact, the people that don't have access to the internet are given access to the internet if they're if they're sampled. And so we're starting to see this movement and recognition that if you want to have the high quality surveying, and if you're going to use the internet, as the Associated Press has decided to do, you know, the world's largest news organization, you need to go to an organization that has built a probability based sample.
Is that the way of the future? Do you anticipate more of that?
It's certainly, yes, very much more. Whether it will eliminate telephone polling for this kind of purposes, it's not clear. Eventually, it may well, as we find more and more people using the internet. You know, we still have a bare majority of the people who routinely use the internet, despite what a lot of studies seem to show. The problem is that those studies are based on internet surveys. And so they're biased right from the start. When you're measuring something about the mode that you're already gathering data, you're not going to get a representative sample. If you do an in-person survey, you get people who have the internet, who don't have the internet, who have it but don't use it. And so you see typical reports showing that 70 to 80% of the people have access to the internet, but that doesn't mean that 70 to 80% of the public uses the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my father is 98 years old, lives in Birmingham. He has access to the internet. He essentially never uses it, you know, and so a lot of people. So the internet is going to be the wave of the future. Mobile phones and accessing people in real, you know, immediately and so forth
with electronic devices,
right? With smartphones and so forth.
We're talking with polling researcher Paul Lavrakis, who is in East Lansing here today. Can you still say then that the telephone polling method is still something of a threshold here because it tends to guarantee a randomness and a wider representation?
I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that telephone polls don't have problems. They have serious problems that people are constantly trying to work on, understand, and try to correct.
What's the biggest one?
The biggest problem affects all surveys, and it's called non-response, that the majority of people who are sampled to participate and contacted refuse to participate. And it's not a random subset of the group that we started out with. It's disproportionately younger people. It's disproportionately people with less education. It's disproportionately minority people. All those factors correlate with political preferences. And so that if you don't do things to either correct it in your methods or correct it with your statistics, your final results in political polls are going to be biased.
Yeah. Non-participation.
Non-participation is what we're talking about. People are so oversaturated with calls, for example, or requests, pop-up ads, and so forth, from a marketing standpoint, that they hear that someone's calling them to do a poll, and if they know it's from a university, usually that's a very positive thing. They usually listen past the initial, few words, but too often they just hang up.
How do you interpret the results of the last presidential race and the polling surrounding that?
Right.
The Republicans were led to believe they had, a much better chance of winning the election,
right,
than the final results suggested.
That was I was on the election night decision team for the Associated Press. I was in Washington working with a small group, six, seven people, who were responsible to the editors of the Associated Press for calling the election using exit poll data and pre-election poll data. And so I've been doing this since 1996, every major election, every other year. And that election was much closer than it appeared to us and to everyone, much closer than it turned out to be. You know, we had the Obama-Romney election. We didn't really know with confidence until about 11 o'clock that night, which is pretty late into the evening, that Obama was going to win. And so although the way that was portrayed, it looked as though it was a much stronger victory, the knowledge that it was going to be that strong a victory wasn't there for us. There was great challenges back then. When you have a close, and that was a close election, when you have a close election, small methods differences can make 1 or 2 points different.
Hmm.
And that can explain why the Gallup organization, a very well-reputed organization, ended up predicting incorrectly who was going to win that election. You know, predicting it, missing it by about 1 percentage point, 2 percentage points. So there are a lot of things that can go wrong. And we had a special problem back then. Remember Hurricane Sandy hit that weekend before the actual election. The people from Washington, D.C. up to Boston were many of the people who were probably, leaning towards Obama, let's say proportionally. They were out of touch either in the internet or the telephone because of the effects of Sandy. And so that was just an extra challenge.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
We've got less than a minute, but I have to ask you about party-originated polls. Yeah. The Democratic polling organization, the right. GOP polling organization.
Right.
What can our listeners learn? What should our listeners be aware of when they see a poll result coming from a polling organization affiliated with one of the major parties?
I think that the quick thing I can say is that no reputable news media reports those polls unless it's a story about political party polling. They don't report them as accurate news. They know not to, because when you're partisan, you're likely to ask questions that are going to be slanted in a way, just simple wording changes or even purposeful changes that are going to bias results. This is just, it's not the kind of thing that news. None of the data aggregators use these kind of polls,
MSU graduate Paul Lavrakis has been our guest. The political polling expert is at work on the latest edition of his book, The Voter's Guide to Election Polls, which comes out in 2015. And Paul will talk at greater length this morning, 10:30 in the Huron Room on the third floor of the MSU Union. It's sponsored by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University. Thanks, Paul. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Some of you may remember author Arnie Bernstein. He's been on the WKAR airwaves before. Most recently, he joined us to talk about the after effects of the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting. The reason we turned to him at that time is that he's the author of the book Bath Massacre, about the 1927 bombing of the school in Bath, Michigan, in which 45 people were killed and many more injured, most of them children. Bernstein's new book is about the rise of an American Nazi movement in the 1930s, which had strong ties to the city of Detroit. It's called Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn, and the Rise and Fall of the German-American Bund. Bernstein spoke with Current State's Melissa Benmark about his book.
The book is about the German-American Bund, which was a pro-Nazi movement of the late 1930s. They were led by a popinjay of a dictator by the name of Fritz Kuhn. He went by the title Bundesführer, and he dreamed of being the Hitler in America and leading a great Nazi movement in America. His great weakness was that he was a womanizer and used Bund money, which he was completely in charge of, to fund his little romances. He was able to marshal a movement that had some considerable force. He had family camps, a youth movement similar to Hitler Youth. He had his own version of the SS, known as the OD. There were meetings across the country. They had uniforms, publications, businesses. If he had been a businessman, a legitimate businessman in the 1930s, he would have been a genius. But again, he had the weakness for women, and despite being married with two kids. And a lot of people went after him. Dewey and LaGuardia, Thomas Dewey and Mayor LaGuardia of New York, decided that they had to stop Fritz Kuhn any way they could after he held a massive rally in Madison Square Garden in February of 1939. 20,000 Bundists were packed in to hear Kuhn and his ilk give their anti-Semitic speeches. 100,000 people were outside in the streets wanting to kill him, wanting to put a stop to this. So Dewey and LaGuardia, obviously they couldn't get him on free speech. They went after him in a different way. They started looking into the taxes, similar to the Capone conviction.
Al Capone, right.
Yeah, they looked at the taxes, and were they paying enough taxes on all the little items they sold and things like that. And then, you know, following the paper trail, they discovered that Kuhn had been embezzling Bund money and forging checks and various papers to fund his romances. This is ultimately what brought him down in the court and sent him to jail. But before that, there were other people who went after him and the Bund, one of whom was Walter Winchell, who pounded away relentlessly in his column on Kuhn. Kuhn said when he was in the White House, he would hang Walter Winchell from the highest lamp pole in front of the Stork Club, which was, of course, Winchell's hangout. And when he was deported, when Kuhn was deported, he told his the officers who were escorting him back to Germany he would live to piss on Winchell's grave.
But that didn't happen either.
Yeah, Kuhn said he would do that. But of course,
he thought he was going to be in the White House.
Yes, he did. That was his ultimate dream.
And what kind of numbers did he have by way of support? No, how many people were involved in this?
That's kind of a tricky number because they were notoriously bad record keepers. They also were very secretive. They had various levels of membership, including one that was for sympathizers who could give anonymously. Estimates range from anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000, 40,000 nationwide at any given point between FBI, newspaper investigations, things like that. But it's really hard to say. Other enemies who went after Kuhn and the Bund included HUAC, which was formed to go after them.
Which is the House...
Un-American Activities Committee.
Right.
Yeah. They were called the Committee Against Un-American Activities or something unwieldy like that, and they later shortened it to HUAC. But they were formed, in essence, to go after Kuhn. And, of course, later, you know, morphed into Joe McCarthy's personal witch hunting unit. And probably the most interesting people who went after the Bund were the boys from the Jewish Mafia. Meyer Lansky, Mickey Cohn, Bugsy Siegel.
I love that you told the story of how Bugsy Siegel got his name.
Oh, God, yeah, he was braver than a bed bug. And nobody wanted to tell him that. Nobody would say that to his face either unless they wanted to pay the consequences. But they were approached, actually. Lansky was approached by some of the highest levels of Jewish leadership and judges anonymously, although Lansky told this to an Israeli journalist and said, you know, can you do something about this? And Lansky eagerly volunteered. And normally they would not let civilians into the organization, but so many people were saying, can we help you? Can we help you? Bugsy Siegel started training people on violent techniques to break up Bund meetings and beat these guys in the streets. Longy's woman, who was sort of the Jewish Tony Soprano, and he controlled New Jersey, he formed an army of prize fighters who would go after these guys and bust up their meetings. Mickey Cohn, of course, out in L.A., was instrumental in organizing that. And then I live in Chicago. There was a little thug named Jacob Rubenstein, who teamed up with his childhood buddy, Barney Ross, who was the former prize fighter. As kids, they used to deliver envelopes for Al Capone at a buck an envelope, no questions asked. They grew up to be kind of street toughs, and Rubenstein was, you know, a low-level mobster. They used to wait in a pool hall for phone calls. They'd say, okay, the Bund's meeting here. They would go to those meetings. They would go, they'd do their work and come back. And Jacob Rubenstein later changed his name to Jack Ruby. And, you know,
no kidding.
The story from there. It's that Jack Ruby.
Wow.
And all his Bund activities were in the Warren Report, of all places. That's where I got a lot of information on Ruby.
Wow. One of the things about this group is that there was a fairly substantial Detroit connection having to do with Henry Ford.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. When Kuhn came to America, he was more or less ran from Germany, went to Mexico, established residency there, and then moved to United States, which was a common thing for a lot of people immigrating at that time. And he was told Henry Ford might be a great place. There's so many people finding work there. Well, of course, Henry Ford, notoriously anti-Semitic, you know, the International Jew, which was published in his newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. And then Ford wrote an apology when people started boycotting his sales and things like that, and he realized he was in trouble. Ford released an apology, let's put it that way, saying, no, he was sorry about all the harm and things that he had caused. Now, that letter was not written by Ford. It was written by one of his flunkies, who was also a master at recreating Ford's signature. Ford never copyrighted the International Jew, which is really strange for a businessman of his, you know, vision and acumen.
Right, who copyrighted everything else.
Exactly.
Right.
So he, in essence, Ford, you know, sent it out into perpetuity. It's still, you know, of course you can download it off any number of, you know, crazy websites these days. And Hitler, of course, was enamored with it, and he had, Ford was the only American to mention in Mein Kampf, and he kept a picture of Ford on his office wall. Ford was awarded in 1938, I believe, a Medal of Honor from the German government which he never returned even after the war broke out. Lindbergh was another one who got that medal and never returned it, by the way. So Ford was the ideal place for Kuhn and a lot of these people to work. Kuhn, because he was trained as a chemist, he got a job in the Henry Ford Hospital, which had a strict policy, no Jewish doctors, which is rather an odd thing when you think about it. And he practiced his speeches in Ford broom closets. He previously had used the broom closets to work his little romances and with other Ford workers, but then switched to practicing speeches, things like that. He was involved with a group that was a predecessor of the Bund called Friends of New Germany. And he eventually rose to the leader of the Detroit branch and then the Midwestern unit he was in charge of.
Wow.
So, I mean, Detroit was a really vital area for the growth of this group and certainly for the, you know, the development of its leader.
So after he was found guilty and of, you know, the tax charges and embezzling and such and was deported, what happened to all those people who had been following him?
Well, the Bund kind of flopped around for a while afterwards. They managed to hang on, in other words, but people started jumping ship. They, you know, they didn't want to be associated with it, and certainly the heat was coming down as the war was raging in Europe, and it was became more obvious that the United States at some point was going to enter. People started, you know, leaving the group in droves, and they floundered along. HUAC kept looking at them, investigating them, and then, of course, there was Pearl Harbor. And that, 6 days later, they officially dissolved the group. But after Kuhn, essentially, they, you know, what Dewey and LaGuardia wanted to do with their court case was to cut off the head of the dragon, and they were successful at that. The Bund hung on for another couple of years, but it was never the same. Their heyday was from 36 to 39.
Why do you find yourself writing, do you think, about people with, shall we say, non-standard beliefs?
That's a good question. I wish I knew the answer. I seem to have a knack for writing about really unsavory people.
Well, that's kind of where I was going with that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other way to put it. There's no polite way to put it. As far as, you know, with Swastika Nation, I will never, ever have a cast of characters this crazy again between, you know, this popinjay of a Nazi leader and Walter Winchell and Ford and the gangsters and, you know, all these crazy people. And then, of course, there were Kuhn's mistresses, one of whom claimed to be Miss America, but was she? You know, have to read the book to find out. And, of course, there's a wonderful story about Bugsy Siegel in there I'm not going to tell. And I mean, it's just so crazy, a cast of characters.
Well, sometimes...
And crazy situations. It was fun to write, even though they were terrible people. They were... at times, I wasn't sure if I was writing a serious drama or a complete farce.
Arnie Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmar.
That's our show for today. Coming up Friday on Current State, we'll talk with Jeff Johns. Jeff's another MSU alum in town for homecoming and a chief creative officer at DC Comics. Also, Airstream trailers are invading Eaton Rapids. Sounds alarming. Find out why tomorrow on Current State. Thanks to producer reporters Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and Melissa Benmark. Also thanks to Kim Geiger and Drew Henderson for technical assistance on our program. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.